Welcome to Focus. I'm Craig Cohen. On this anniversary of the attacks of September 11th, 2001, it's in some ways pretty easy to identify how our world has changed in the years since those attacks. Just visit your nearest airport, where in the interest of security, our bags are screened more carefully. We walk through full body scanners. We accept pat-downs when necessary. We might once have characterized one or more of those procedures as invasions of privacy, but in the name of security, mostly we abide them. But security is just one reason our notions of what should be private have changed. Our culture seems to be increasingly voyeuristic. We expect tell-all books. We're enamored by scandal. But it's not just what we learn about others and their private lives. Others know more than ever about our lives. Whole sectors of our economy are shaped by who can access and distribute information about us most effectively. Heck, through social media and search engines, we share that information ourselves and then are bombarded by advertising catered to our interest. Face it, sometimes even unknowingly, we share all sorts of information that we once deemed private. So how do we define privacy today? Is it a right to be protected or a privilege few, if any, have? And what in this world can we, in fact, keep private just for ourselves? Today on Focus, we examine what privacy means in 21st century America. My guest is Garrett Kaiser. He's a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and the author of several books. His newest is entitled simply Privacy. Garrett Kaiser, welcome to Focus.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Garrett, how do you define privacy in America today? Can it be defined effectively?
Well, defining privacy is challenging, and more challenging the more abstract your consideration of it. It's much easier when we're looking at particular violations of privacy. I'm happy to employ a definition that others have used, that privacy is our ability to control access to ourselves. I root it in our creaturely resistance to being used or interfered with or penetrated against our will.
There are lots of reasons we can at times be willing to sacrifice some measure of privacy, from security to convenience to fitting into cultural norms. What compromises of privacy would you say have, for lack of a better term, irked you the most in recent years?
Well, I guess what's irked me the most is not so much seeing the number of people who appear to devalue their own privacy, which I think is sometimes used as a distraction from more pressing privacy issues. So we focus on what other people are doing on Facebook instead of what perhaps government and corporations are doing to us. I think what irks me most is the kind of impotent, fatalistic resignation to the loss of privacy. The idea that privacy is dead and that if you want to be a good team player, you need to accept that. An idea that's being promoted by people who have abundant privacy and abundant resources for protecting their own privacy, even as they issue statements to the peons below their battlements that privacy is dead and they better get over it.
Can you give some examples?
Give some examples
of this sort of fatalistic resignation.
Well, one encounters it all the time. When I was first beginning to write my book, a man asked me, "So what are you writing now?" And I said, "I'm writing a book about privacy." And he said it was a good idea for about 200 years. Too bad it couldn't have lasted. And I suppose you could say the same thing about, you know, the Bill of Rights and habeas corpus and literacy and human kindness if you wanted to go that far. But if you did, then why write any book at all? If things are that hopeless, why have this conversation now?
Right. I mentioned up front a number of reasons that we might be willing to sacrifice a little bit of privacy. I was wondering if we could talk about some examples of each. The first most obvious one and appropriate on the anniversary of the September 11th, 2001 attacks is privacy versus security. So
yes.
There are things like scanners at airports and strip searches. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think we don't do any service to ourselves or to our right to privacy when we take the right to privacy and we make it an absolute. Like any other value, it needs to be considered relative to other values. like freedom of the press, and also, as you point out, in a post 9/11 age, our need for security. However, I think that needs to be done critically and thoughtfully, and I think there are questions we need to ask ourselves. Among those questions are, which procedures are for security, are motivated by our security needs, and which of them are motivated by the desire to make us subservient? To what extent do we undermine our way of life by being willing to do anything to protect it? Or to put it more specifically, when do our security measures, do the terrorists work for them in destroying the way of life that we've come to think of as American? Are the watchers themselves subject to surveillance? Is the surveillance being enhanced by technology, or is it being driven by technology so that whatever the technological tool enables us to do, we then think that we ought to do? And finally, and I think maybe most pertinent to this day, which is also a day when we not only remember the people who perished in the towers, but the people who perished aboard Flight 93 resisting their captors, is our best way of fighting terrorism by turning a population of citizens into sheep? I question that it is, and I question that our enemies quake in their boots when they see us submitting without question to strip searches and to certain other procedures. I would think it rather encouraged them, or rather would encourage them.
Would you say, you started off in listing those questions, saying that what's important is that we think critically about each of those. Do you think we as a society, simply have not?
There are few answers, there are few questions that I can answer, you know, unequivocally yes or no, but in this case I can, and I would say no, I don't think we've thought critically about them, and I think that is typical of people who are afraid. And at least in the immediate period after post 9/11, there were two fears, at the very least. The one was the very understandable and reasonable fear of terrorism and of being killed by people who intend to kill us. But there was also, I think, on the part of our leaders, a fear of being perceived as soft on terror. I mean, the USA Patriot Act, which was passed in a very quick period of time, is, you know, a 300-plus page document. I'm not the first to have wondered whether the people who voted for it even had time to read it. But the important thing was not to be seen as, breaking step, united we stand, and all of that. And I think that's precisely the kind of time, the kind of period when we need to be vigilant, and we need to not to check our brains out as we attempt to defend ourselves.
So those political and security implications clearly are established, but privacy is also threatened today by other factors, among them sort of simple convenience. You think of smartphone applications that allow you to scan something and then get a discount on a product or a service, and then the company that provides that has information about your shopping habits. Some see this as a win-win. It's convenient. It's useful. What do you think?
Well, what I think and discuss at some length in the book is that convenience is antithetical to any notion of the sacred, whether it be a political notion or a religious notion or just a personal notion. You think of anything that's sacred or that you regard as sacred, and it often involves a measure of inconvenience. I mean, if you stand for a moment of silence on September 11th and remove your hat, and that means you go without a cigarette, a candy bar, without moving, without doing some of the other things you might want to do, turning off your cell phone. All of that is grossly inconvenient, but you say, well, given what we lost and given that these were our brothers and sisters were willing to bear that inconvenience. Once you make convenience your highest good, then anything that stands in the way of inconvenience becomes subsidiary and dispensable. All that matters is getting what you want, when you want it, in as quick and cheap a way as you can get it. And I don't think that that value is especially conducive to democracy, to community, or to human dignity. It's certainly very conducive to a consumer marketplace.
Are you saying privacy should be sacred?
I would say that, but more than that, I would say that some of the things that privacy protects ought to be sacred, like individual self-determination, private conversation, intimate association, one's right to make decisions that affect one's own life and body. Those things should be sacred. I'm about a week away from visiting a relative who's in a rehabilitation center, and I visited nursing homes and rehabilitation centers very often, and I'm at an age where I start wondering when I might end up in one too. And we go into those places and we're immediately confronted with questions about, you know, the sacredness of people, their right to have their stuff not stolen or messed with, their right to be able to use the bathroom without having somebody open up a door and say, your doctor's here, the right simply to wrap a curtain around where their bed is and to have a few moments to talk, to think, to pray, whatever. I think that those things are sacred, and I don't want to live in a world where they are not.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and my guest is Garrett Kaiser, author of the new book Privacy. In it, he explores how our notions of what is private and what is not are ever-changing and what factors affect what we deem we have the right to keep private today. We welcome your questions and comments about privacy and how it's affected by politics, technology, culture, economics, and other factors. You can join us on air by calling 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email your question or comment to will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 333-WILL or 800-222-WILL. There are cultural implications for privacy as well. We live in a world where we are encouraged to share all sorts of things in the interest of getting something out in the open. Is openness always good?
Well, no. I don't think that openness is always good, no more than many other behaviors or values are good in every single circumstance. And not only that, but openness is often not even openness. So you're in a situation where someone says, usually someone with an agenda that would be served by having you spill your guts, and someone says, you know, we're all friends here, nobody has anything to hide, we have no secrets, and so let's be open. It is in fact in that circumstance that most of us will clam up, and the openness really becomes just a cover for sham and hypocrisy and dishonesty.
I mentioned the word share, you know, that we're encouraged to share all sorts of things. You note in your book, and it sort of struck me, I guess this is right at the top of the book, in fact, that the word sharing today has almost everything to do with personal information and almost nothing to do with, well, as you point out, personal wealth, but really what we would characterize sharing once upon a time as being stuff, you know, money, resources. That's what, you know, once upon a time we would share. Why is it, do you think, that term has sort of changed in how we use it?
Well, I want to be careful in answering that question that I don't start promulgating conspiracy theories. I mean, I think certain cultural phenomena come about in ways that are difficult to parse. Nevertheless, it does strike me as peculiar and at least interestingly ironic that even as we're prattling on about sharing, that we see this appalling income divide between the very rich and what they have and the very poor and what they do not have, including much privacy, and the shrinking of the middle class. And even as our resources are not being, in my mind, justly distributed among people who help to generate that commonwealth, and even when you extend that to environmental resources, to future generations, that we're talking all the time about sharing. It's a somewhat superficial sharing against that background. And I think it's also a kind of distraction. So you have people who have been deprived of certain benefits of the social contract, certain of the legacies of organized labor, certain of the hopes that people in previous generations could look forward to in their old age. And while all of these things are being taken off the table and out of their pockets, their eyes are mesmerized by the appearance of a rich social life that, in fact, is largely an illusion and is largely just a matter of bread and circuses to keep your eyes busy while the expropriation takes place.
We've talked a little bit about security and convenience and cultural implications for privacy, and we were just touching on the edges of technology, but I wanted to talk a little bit about that. How else has technology in the guise of computers, the online world, smartphones, and so forth, how has that threatened our privacy?
Well, I would start out by saying when we use the word technology, of course, we're really talking about two things. We're talking about a set of devices, but we're also talking about a kind of fundamentalist religion that's grown up around those devices, such that, you know, the only means to salvation is to use those devices and to use them for everything, and to believe that technological developments are a law unto themselves. They're sort of like the gods. They're not to be directed towards social ends by intelligent human beings, but by a kind of blind market, which is also a god and a fate that should not be opposed. Technology, the tools of technology, have certainly enabled us to look into the privacy of others in ways that were not possible before. I find, you know, the history of digital technology to be somewhat ironic in that regard. First of all, because many of these devices were developed by individuals within private settings, within clubs, with a Facebook grew up in a Harvard dorm, even as those who developed them and profited from them got to tell other people that their privacy was dead and got to increase their own privacy with everything else that money can buy. I think some of the devices are also ironic. And by the way, I own some of these devices, and I'm not insinuating that they're, you know, sources of unqualified wickedness. But it's interesting that many of these devices were marketed to us really in an appeal to our privacy. You know, we'd have a personal computer, and we could be in our own little world there. We could get a GPS. We wouldn't have to ask anybody directions. We could get a cell phone. We wouldn't have to go into a phone booth. We could get an iPad, and we wouldn't, or a Kindle, and we wouldn't have to touch any dirty books at the public library. So we could have this wonderful digital cave of privacy, and lo and behold, it turned out to be a glass house, so that we removed ourselves from members of our community, from our neighbors, only to expose ourselves to opportunistic strangers. And to think about that, even briefly and superficially, is somewhat disturbing. And I suppose if I wasn't in the midst of it, it would even be funny. But I'm not a god. I'm a human being. And so it's disturbing.
Well, I should hope so. Otherwise, we were talking about the wrong subject.
That's right.
But you know, you do raise an interesting point, which is that when we talk about privacy, Sometimes I imagine some folks might misinterpret that and say, oh, well, you're talking about being reclusive or not interacting with the world around you. But that's not really what we're getting at, right?
Oh, no, not at all. You know, privacy is one's right to withdraw, but also one's right to step out of that. And one of the things that a healthy regard for privacy allows and promotes is those first tentative steps away from seclusion. If I know my privacy will be respected, then I feel at liberty to share my thoughts and emotions with a friend. And perhaps as a result of that interaction, whether it be over a beer or whether it be in a letter, then I find the courage to step out even further. I find resources to form my thoughts further. So privacy and sociability are by no means opposites. They're two sides of the same coin, and you can test that idea in a number of ways. One of which is to see if it's not true, as I believe it is true, that when private life is eroded, public life tends to get shabby too. And the other is to think about people you know who either make wonderful public contributions or have rich and fulfilling private lives. If you know people that you think have rich and fulfilling and beautiful private lives, do you find those people, you know, going through other people's garbage to find out smarmy details or surfing the net for the wardrobe malfunctions of the stars? They enjoy their private life, but they also tend to be people who reach out and engage publicly in meaningful ways. And likewise, look at any of the public figures that you respect, whether currently or in history, and you often find individuals who also went apart in order to restore and nourish themselves and to rediscover the resources that enabled them to serve others.
This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Garrett Kaiser, author of the book Privacy. We're considering what privacy means in 21st century America and how it's affected by economics, politics, technology, and our culture at large. To join the conversation, we welcome your questions or comments at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455. You can email questions or comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. We also welcome comments via WILL's Facebook and Twitter pages or on our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. That phone number again, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. To underscore what you were just talking about, I want to read a quote from your book, one sentence. You write, "We have become as sanctimonious in our zeal to expose and reveal as any repressed Victorian was to conceal and deny." Compare us to that Victorian era and perceptions of what privacy meant then and now.
Well, I don't know if I'm enough of a history of culture to do that in an effective way, but we have this notion, and I think it's somewhat supported by what we read in literature, that, you know, some of our predecessors were very reserved people. There were things that were not mentioned, that were not spoken in public. It was considered even bad manners to take a female overnight guest and put her in a room with a picture that had a man in it because she'd be undressing in front of this painting of a man. And in all of that, I think we notice a certain pathology, and we notice some things that were problems with that kind of reserve and that kind of privacy, not least of all the way in which privacy was used as a cloak to cover the oppression of women, of children, of workers, of persons of color. You know, the paterfamilias had his privacy to protect, and it was really a cloak that allowed him to do whatever he wanted. And that, you know, echoes something I said earlier, that privacy is by no means an unqualified virtue. But then I think somewhat in our reaction to that, and also driven by a market culture and a media culture, and by certain mistaken notions of pop psychology, we've evolved the idea that by showing everything we can possibly show, we're exhibiting our health. We're showing that we have nothing to hide. We're being good citizens and good neighbors. And what does this amount to but just another version of that same kind of prissy rectitude that we noted in some of our Victorian ancestors? So they kept everything buttoned up and felt very self-righteous about it, and we take off all our clothes and feel very self-righteous about it. I don't know what you'd call that, but I have a hard time calling it social evolution.
So is it, like with so many things, a question of moderation, of balance, of saying there are some elements, some concepts in our lives that we should keep private, and some things that can be public, and it's just up to us to determine what those are?
Well, you know, moderation has been recognized as a virtue since the time of the Greeks, and there's certainly a place for it, and there's certainly perhaps not a place for it. And one of the places where I would suspect moderation is when we focus on these issues like privacy, apart from larger issues such as what kind of a society do we want to build? So, you know, It's a kind of blind lane, a dead end to just consider, well, what relative degree of exposure versus privacy is optimal. I think rather we should look and say, how can people live in such a way that they're recognized as our equals, that they have meaningful lives, that they have meaningful work, that they are able to confront each other as fellow Americans, where fellow American is not some kind of abstraction that covers people who are so different in their privileges and in their wealth that they might as well be members of different species. What will make America a place with liberty and justice for all? And I think you address that. And many of these issues, subsidiary issues like privacy, and obviously I think privacy is very, very important, or I wouldn't have written a book about it, but I think some of those issues will take care of themselves if we have the courage and the critical discipline, the intellectual discipline, to look behind those issues at larger questions of what kind of a society do we want to have. To take a question that's the title of one of Wendell Berry's books, what are people for, and how do we act on what we believe they're for?
We'll continue our conversation with Garrett Kaiser, author of the book Privacy, in just a minute. We also welcome your calls at 333-9455 or 800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. This is Focus. This is Focus. I'm Craig Cohen, and we're talking with Garrett Kaiser, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and the author of several books. His newest is entitled simply Privacy, and that is the topic of our discussion today, what privacy means in 21st century America. How would past generations, Garrett, of Americans feel about so many of us being increasingly willing to share just about every detail of our daily lives?
Well, I don't know how past generations might feel. Certainly among living generations, there's a concern among some older people that some younger people are perhaps sharing things that they might grow up to regret, or sharing and not fully realizing the implications of sharing so much. And I think that those concerns are certainly well-founded. However, I become uneasy when a preoccupation with people's voluntary sharing of personal information begins to obscure the much more troubling question of when our information is taken without our consent. I mean, I think people have a right to share their own information. What disturbs me is when their standard for sharing is applied to me in some kind of totalitarian way. If people want to use social media sites like Facebook and fully realize what they're sacrificing when they do that, I might shake my head a bit, but I'm, as a private individual, I'm inclined to see that as their business. When someone feels I can no longer be a respectable member of the human race without a Facebook page, that disturbs me. It also disturbs me when I hear people, especially people my age, and we're talking middle age for your listeners, decry the social media habits of young people and the idea that young people don't care about privacy, or even laud that as some kind of evolutionary step. I think that that is in some ways a libel against young people, many of whom value their privacy very much. And even those who don't value their privacy, I want to know, where are they learning that from? Are they getting, you know, messages from extraterrestrials? Or are they learning to devalue their privacy because, in fact, those of us who are older have essentially taught them that, have taught them to value celebrity, have taught them to worship openness. But I question the idea that younger people don't care about their privacy, and I'm not sure whether that's good social analysis when we say that or merely smart marketing. Let's convince a whole generation that they're the people who don't care about privacy, and then they'll be all the more vulnerable to the products we're going to sell them that require them to sacrifice their privacy.
Let's take a call. We have Paul on the line from Champaign County. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning again. Yeah, this sort of segues with yesterday's show in a way, in the sense that that was more about the dimension of interconnectedness and social networking, et cetera. But I want to beat the drum again about River Glass, which is a corporation that does data mining and is based here at the research park. And I don't know exactly what they do. SAIC is out there, and they're very close. They play everything very close to the vest about what they do, but it's a huge concern. And I was taken by this so much some years ago that I read Spies for Hire by Tim Shorrock, where he goes through the whole privatization of intelligence. And that's, one says that we need this kind of analysis, but then when you turn over so much of it to private enterprise, and without the theoretical controls by government to keep track of how these powerful tools are being used. So I don't know if that provokes a reaction. It's not in the form of a question, but.
All right. No, thank you very much for the call. Garrett, you do get into some of this in your book, some of the implications that are economic, that deal with the impact that a perceived, shrinking of privacy has on the corporate world and how government can influence it as well. Do you see a connection between what the caller's talking about and what you were writing about?
Well, I see a very interesting correlation between two trends. One, the trend toward increasing privatization of hitherto public institutions. We privatized the military. We are talking about privatizing education. There are strong forces that would like to do that. We've all but privatized our postal communication through email. We seem to feel safer entrusting our communications to the executives of Yahoo and Google than to the U.S. Postal Service. And yet, in this move toward privatization, have we gained more privacy or less? And I even have a chapter in my book in which I say privacy is not privatization. And I would urge a kind of critical suspicion of any easy linking of the word private and the word privacy. There's an interesting historical factor here in what your caller, Paul, pointed out. Our notions of privacy in America, which are rooted in the Bill of Rights and rooted in our history as a colony that broke away from Great Britain are very much grounded in a fear of government. The Bill of Rights was appended to the Constitution by people who were concerned, and with good reason, about the overreaching of government. And Americans have tended historically, and with good reason, to define the right of privacy over and against the encroachment of government. The problem is we've reached a phase in our history, we may have reached it earlier than now, when private corporations actually not only have more power than government, but may, in certain significant ways, be running the government. So we're sort of like people, pioneers gathered around one window of the cabin, guarding ourselves against attacks from the outside, even as the arrows are coming in from a very different window, and that window being the private corporation.
Now, that said, you also, though, talk about some of the court challenges that have been sought to define privacy, and those, for the most part, relate to challenges, again, to government power, not corporate power. But I'm wondering if you think there has been a turn away from legal efforts to protect us from government overreach towards going in the other direction in court cases in recent years. I think of there was a recent Supreme Court case involving strip searches, as an example, or recent cases involving search and seizure. That are we sort of veering in the other direction now?
Well, I think we veer back and forth in regard to control of the government in the matter of strip searches. You're referring, I assume, to Florence versus the Chosen Board of Freeholders,
right,
about a strip search case. And I think many people would be appalled to know the extent to which strip searching is practiced. In our nation's capital, people have been strip searched for such heinous offenses as eating donuts on crosstown buses where eating is prohibited, or pulling by mistake into a parking garage they couldn't afford, and then turning around and leaving only to find themselves subjected to a full strip search. By the same token, the court ruled in 2011 in United States versus Jones. They ruled that the use of a GPS to track a suspect without a search warrant was a violation of Fourth Amendment rights. So I'd hesitate to say that that the pendulum is swinging all the way back in some other direction. But I do think that we do well to be suspicious of government intrusions upon our privacy. But by the same token, we're not necessarily helped by the notion that government can't do anything right. Because if that's true, then what does that say about democracy, since presumably government is created and sustained by the people? If it's not, we need to do something about that. But to simply say that any kind of government at all, any kind of government control, anything other than unbridled entrepreneurial initiative is suspicious and faulty and bad leaves us very much at the mercy of any number of threats to our privacy that will not be controlled or bridled without certain judicial and legislative action.
So then what ultimately is the solution? If you have this perception that privacy is threatened by corporate influences, by government influences, by economic conditions, by security concerns, by all of these different factors, cultural factors as well, what's the ideal world? What should we aim for that would be different from what we experience today?
Well, I, for one, don't expect to see an ideal world, at least on this side of the grave. And I don't think that there's any one prevailing solution, or really any thorough solution. I think privacy is always going to be a somewhat contested value, if only because it rubs up against other competing values, and that dialectic is just part of what it is to be a human being, part of what it means to be a social animal. But I do think there are some things that can be done, and they can be done on several levels, one of which, not the least of which, is simply to let the powers that be know that privacy is important to us, and perhaps even by certain acts of resistance or renunciation in airports and our consumer choices. I mean, when you go into a fast food restaurant now, you're going to find a place to recycle. And the reason you're going to find that is because the corporate owners of those fast food places discovered that recycling and environmental responsibility were important to the people getting burgers at the counter. And once they discovered that, then they needed to take action. There's legislative initiatives that can be undertaken. I'm thinking of my own Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy's proposed amendment to the 1986 Electronic Communications Privacy Act, which he introduced into Congress in 86 and is now trying to update to bring it more in line with the digital age. We need to remember that some of our privacy guarantees are rooted in constitutional amendments that were framed when we didn't have the digital devices that we currently have. I also think, you know, in our own lives, there are certainly things that we can do to protect our own privacy by not making it subservient to convenience, by letting it be known it's important to us, by simple interactions. I mean, I've tried to cultivate the practice of saying, why do you need to know this? When someone asks me what I regard as an intrusive question, why do you need to know this? And often I discover at the pharmacy, the doctor's office, whatever, that somebody doesn't need to know this, but they just figured they'd ask it anyway to see what I would say. And what I say is, I don't see any reason for you to know this, and I'm not going to tell you. I also, with others, try to, you know, let people know that they don't have to tell me every particular of their recent cancer operation, including showing me the scar, if they need me just to take them for radiation treatments or mind the cat. I don't need all the information. I only need to know how I can serve so that, you know, I make some kind of contribution. I think also, though, to go back to something I said earlier, we can look at larger issues that impact privacy. Privacy depends on our social contract. It is our togetherness as a society that gives us a right to privacy. Without that social contract, there is no right to privacy. There are no rights. There's just me with a club in my hand defending me and mine. But I think our social contract is under threat when we see such vast discrepancies in wealth and in well-being that, as I said before, make the term fellow Americans almost begin to seem like an abstraction. If the social contract is under attack, so is privacy. If you care about your privacy, then I think you need to care about what your poor, unemployed, unregarded neighbor has to think of as his own or her own, and to do something about that. Not caring about the social contract and caring about your privacy is like not caring about global warming, but caring about your beachfront house. Sooner or later, the water's going to rise.
I'm glad you mentioned this idea that there are moments when you have to say to someone, well, why do you want to know that? Yeah. You did something in the midst of your book that I thought, well, this is brilliant. What a great idea. You interviewed a pair of women who were pregnant, and you sort of noted the kinds of questions they got and how they had to navigate the world a little bit differently because they were showing.
Yeah. I mean, pregnancy is an I mean, I've never been pregnant, but pregnancy's an interesting experience for women in that, you know, at a certain point it becomes a public matter, even though it's based on some very private physiological, sexual, social realities. And I found it interesting to talk to those women about how they navigated that paradox in public and in their relationships to others. But I walked away from those conversations feeling inspired. And what inspired me was the fact that these people were exercising their intelligence and their freedom, and in a few instances, even their courage to maintain a life of dignity that made sense to themselves, and insisting on a certain respect for their privacy without being ashamed of their bodies or their condition, but also not buying into everyone else's definition of what everyone has a, quote, right to know, unquote. And I found that inspiring, and I found it instructive, and that's one of the reasons that I use those interviews in concluding my book.
We have just a minute or two left, and we do have somebody on the line. I want to try and get this call in quickly. Danny's in Champaign. Danny, go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted your guest's reaction to something that happened to me. A couple of years ago, I was falsely accused of a crime, and I was actually arrested. And during my bail hearing, in order to try and get me denied bail, the prosecutor actually brought up that I do not have a Twitter or a Facebook account, and that somehow that makes me unusual and odd. And I just was kind of appalled and stunned that the prosecutor would actually try and use that in lieu of any actual evidence if he had none.
Wow.
And I'll go ahead and hang up, but I wanted to get your guest reaction to that.
All right, thanks very much for the call. Garrett?
Well, I wasn't the person in the court, as your caller was, but I'm equally appalled, though not surprised, by that. And I think that that refers to the kind of totalitarian aspect that some of these social media have come to have. And they're called social media, but let's not forget that they are big business, and there is a vested interest in seeing that anyone who does not participate in them is considered abnormal. If that is called freedom, then I need someone to call in the next 10 seconds and explain to me what is slavery or subservience.
And that is an interesting place for us to leave it. Garrett Kaiser is contributing editor at Harper's Magazine and the author of several books. His newest is entitled simply Privacy. Garrett, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. I've enjoyed being on, and thanks to you and to your callers.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. You can go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus, or we're likely the first result on your search engine under Will Focus. You now have a second chance to hear this program each weeknight at 8 on WILL AM 580. If you know somebody who might enjoy hearing the program but is unable to listen to us weekday mornings at 10, let them know about our nightly rebroadcasts at 8 p.m. And if you know anyone who might enjoy hearing Focus who lives outside of our listening area, let them know. We stream the program live each day at will.illinois.edu, where you can also listen back to past programs. This program is also available as a free downloadable podcast. On tomorrow's show, research in recent years has indicated the elderly tend to live longer if their homes are near a park or another green space. College students with dorm room views of natural settings perform better on cognitive tests. Children with ADHD have fewer symptoms after spending time in lush outdoor areas. Public housing residents interact more if they live near trees. And conversely, people who live in urban settings that lack trees and grass tend to be more violent and more aggressive. So is it as simple as the more trees around you, the healthier, more productive, and happier you are? Or do we just happen to seek out places to live and work that reflect the personalities we already have? So peaceful, socially engaged people seek out trees, while more aggressive, intense people naturally prefer a big city. Are there other factors at play? Often there are. Just what is the connection between our environment and our ability to interact, learn, and live healthy? We'll talk about it on tomorrow's program. Today's show is produced by Travis Stansel. Other members of our focus team are Pam Dempsey, Kimberly Cronick, and Jim Meadows. Jason Croft is our technical director and handled your calls today. I'm Craig Cohen.